The U.S. is the world's next oil giant. From APM, it's the Marketplace Midday Update podcast. I'm Jeff Horwich. We've rolled around to another Monday. It's November 12th. The International Energy Agency has seen the future for the U.S., and it involves producing lots and lots of oil. Also, a post-election check-in with those swinging folks we've come to know so well in Loudoun County, Virginia. And what Greece and Cuba Gooding Jr., I guess, have in common on this Monday. Show me the money.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
A report this morning from the International Energy Agency contains a striking headline. The IEA forecasts the U.S., not Saudi Arabia, not Russia, the U.S. will become the biggest oil producer in the world by around 2020. By 2030, the agency expects the U.S. will be a net exporter of oil. Samuel Chishik is an oil supply consultant at KBC Energy Economics in London. Good to talk with you.
Well, pleasure being here. Thanks.
The idea of the U.S. as the world's largest oil producer, I think for a lot of people, that prospect is kind of like, where did that come from? So what's happening that would lead the IEA to project that by 2020 or so?
Well, I mean, we've seen the boom in shale oil production, which is bringing the U.S. back to this position it once had, but of course many decades ago.
And remind us what shale oil production is again.
Well, it's a production from very tight reservoirs, so shale, basically, which has been pioneered in the U.S. First, there was a very big boom in producing gas from shale in the last few years, and the technologies have now very successfully for a couple of years now been transferred to oil.
So shale oil production is kind of messy.
Well, no, that's more the oil shale, and one has to make a difference between those two because they're very, very different. So oil shale production is what a lot of people will think of, also call tar. Sort of like production mainly in Canada. The shale is not itself messy, but it requires technologies like fracking to break up the shale formations underground and sort of free up gas or oil from the sort of pockets where it's trapped, to simplify it.
So oil shale and shale oil production, that's an important distinction for folks to learn about going forward, huh?
It is, yes, exactly. It's an important. But in the U.S., it's really the sort of the oil shale, which has been booming, and this has been adding so much more production capacity in the last few years.
What does the IEA have to say about the prospects for renewable energy sources as a part of our global energy mix?
Well, I mean, you know, they see continued growth, particularly in the U.S. Regulatory measures to raise environmental standards in fuels, for instance, are already calling for high levels of biofuels in the mix. So, I mean, there will be growth. It's being sort of spurred by legislation, and they don't really see that as anything that will diminish.
Thinking about this prospect of the U.S. becoming the world's largest oil producer and an oil exporter, they say, by 2030, geopolitically, that's going to have some very interesting implications, wouldn't you think?
Well, it could have. It would be much easier for isolationist forces in the U.S. to advocate taking a step back and not getting as much involved in, for instance, the Middle East. It's not like the U.S. will be disconnected from the global markets or from the oil price. But, you know, there won't be sort of a direct sort of supply at stake for the U.S. in the same way. And it might change things. It might change relationships, particularly with big suppliers in the U.S.
Samuel Chishik is an oil supply consultant. He's at KBC Energy Economics with me from London. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Worth noting that the IEA also gets into climate change and energy efficiency in the report. The agency says that policymakers the world over still, quote, fall well short of the economic gains that they could achieve just by using energy more efficiently. It also says the window's closing to meet the internationally agreed upon goal of limiting global temperature increases to 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. All right. Let's do the numbers. Well, in the first hour of trading, we watched an optimistic market, but things have turned south, and who knows what the day may bring. But at this hour, the S&P, the NASDAQ, and the Dow are all down about 0.2%. Japan says its economy shrank about 1% in the latest quarter. That suggests a mild recession underway in the world's third largest economy. Late yesterday, the Greek parliament overlooked the usual massive protests and pushed through a painful package of spending cuts and tax hikes. Passing the austerity budget was seen as essential to unlock the next batch of European bailout money, about $40 billion. Without it, Greece actually can't afford bond payments that are due on Friday. From our Marketplace European desk in London, Stephen Beard is with me now. Hello.
Hello, Jeff.
So the Greeks got it done. They passed the 2013 budget. Why isn't the money flowing?
Well, this isn't easy. Greece's European partners and the IMF have the classic creditor's dilemma. Do they throw good money after bad, or do they withhold further cash and watch Greece go bust and see the billions they've already pumped into the country disappear in a puff of smoke? So it isn't easy. There's also the moral hazard question. They don't want to seem a soft touch to the Greeks. They want to keep the Greeks guessing. Having said that, however, it does seem that eventually the creditors will agree and the Greeks will get the bailout money.
Does anybody really believe, though, that when all's said and done here, Greece is going to be able to get out of this and pay all its debts?
I don't see how anyone can believe that, Jeff. I mean, you can't pay these huge debts if your economy is contracting and the Greek economy will soon enter its sixth year of recession. But there's a big political problem looming. In Germany, the largest single contributor to the bailout, so far, the German taxpayers have been told, you're not giving this money to Greece. It's a loan. It's earning interest. Now, very soon, perhaps within the next week or so, it seems very likely the German government's going to have to say, sorry, folks, some of that money we lent to Greece will have to be written off. It wasn't a loan after all. It was a gift. And that's not going to go down very well with the German taxpayers.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thank you.
Okay, Jeff.
U.S. bond markets are closed today to mark Veterans Day, which technically fell yesterday on a Sunday this year. It's the right time, though, to make note of a new social network exclusively for the military. Two retired officers are behind the effort. Think of it kind of like a modern-day VFW hall. From WBUR in Boston, here's Kurt Nickisch.
Major Jake Johnston teaches at West Point. As a new subscriber to the website called Rally Point, he likes being able to use Army lingo.
Because we speak that common language, and when I say OH-58D, every aviation officer you've ever met knows exactly what I'm talking about.
People in the military move around so much, and they meet new people professionally everywhere they go, and then they move again.
That's Aaron Kletzing. He built Rally Point with Enon Weiss after the two Army veterans met at Harvard Business School and realized they'd both served together north of Baghdad. You have to have a military email address to sign up for their for-profit website. You list your rank and deployments. Weiss says instead of business units, the hierarchy goes by command structure.
There's a misconception in the military that people cannot influence their careers, that they just get orders every couple years and they just go to where they're told.
And that attitude doesn't work in today's tough job market. Weiss says service members need to be networking for the right civilian job long before they leave the military. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nickisch for Marketplace.
Another quick web-related sidebar here. The launch of a new website from the city of Winnipeg has stumbled out of the gate. Surefoot.org was supposed to provide a pedestrian winter walking forecast. The idea was to prevent slips and falls. But according to Canada's QMI news agency, when Winnipeg's first big snowfall hit on Saturday, Surefoot.org proclaimed it was 73 degrees out and sunny. Whoopsie-daisy.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at Marketplace.org.
For the past couple of months, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has brought us dispatches from Loudoun County, Virginia. Her mission, to take the temperature of one of the swingier counties in this important swing state. Turns out it was a pretty accurate barometer. Virginia and Loudoun County ended up going for Obama by just about the same margin. Today, Nancy heads back to Loudoun County to ask voters about the future.
It's a busy Thursday morning at a diner in Leesburg, Virginia. I've assembled a small group of Loudoun County voters at a table in the back. There are retirees, small business owners, a lawyer. Some voted for President Obama, some for Governor Romney. One voted Libertarian. Divided at the polls, they now share a common concern: how to unite the country and get it back on track economically. Glenn Bayless is a retired teacher. He says members of Congress should learn to get along.
The obstructionism, I think, is a priority you ought to stop. And I think it will go a long way to solving some of the issues with the economy.
The foremost issue for Bayless and the others here, avoiding the fiscal cliff of tax hikes and budget cuts. My focus group consists mostly of swing voters and ticket splitters. Most of the Obama supporters here also voted to re-elect their local congressman, who's a Republican. For the life of them, these voters can't understand why the people they elect can't reach across party lines. Our waitress, Miriam Nasuti, stops by with coffee refills and an opinion about what President Obama should do now.
Sometimes you need to have that late night cocktail with the speaker, you know, and people on the other side of the fence.
But these voters are acutely aware that they elected the partisan politicians they're now complaining about. Sergio Loya is a government contractor. He voted a straight party ticket, but now he's doing some soul searching, saying he'll only vote for candidates who promise to compromise.
If they don't, then in whatever period of time, 2, 4, 6 years, vote them out.
There are nods of agreement around the table, but local distillery owner Scott Harris says we should also change our behavior outside the voting booth.
It seems like lately, Facebook before the election and now after, people are pretty nasty to each other, and these are all of our close circles and friends, and it's really polarizing us even more.
So befriend your foes, vote for peacemakers, and maybe, just maybe, Congress and the White House will get the message. In Loudoun County, Virginia, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
And finally, after the big storm out east, some people are still in shelters. A few folks are still waiting for power. For others, though, more mundane concerns are back on the front burner. Among other things, the media in New York have taken note of Sandy's apparent effect on people's weight. During the storm, fresh food was understandably kind of hard to come by. Cheetos and Oreos, on the other hand, a little bit more accessible. And people had a good excuse, of course, for stress eating. We're not talking about an extreme amount of weight gain. A Time magazine blogger has labeled the phenomenon the Sandy Five, kind of like the Freshman 15, if you're familiar with that. I like this quote from a woman in the New York Times. It was kind of like the movies, she says. What you eat in the dark doesn't count. And that is all for today's Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is APM, American Public Media.